Hi, and welcome to the Politics of Justice. It's me, Amy Austin. So, I did put up a video at this point, who knows how many weeks ago, saying I was going to do this series where I talk about the books and the stories behind the stories. You know, it seemed, to be frank, it seemed like a lovely idea, probably at 3 a.m. when my perimenopausal self was up, but I woke up and I realized that seemed hard and a lot of work. To be frank, I'm not sure what sort of structure it's going to be, how long the videos would be, what it would be to do this. So I decided to just start. It's Tuesday, why not? And by the way, I am doing this instead of watching a Josh Johnson premiere. Also, so you know, Judge, the book I'm breaking down in this video is free on all platforms. I wanted readers to be able to jump into Casey's story without any barriers. So if you haven't read it yet, you can download it anywhere you get ebooks. It's also available in audio and at your local library. So here we are. So the book I'm going to talk about is Judged. It's behind me. And let me start with the current back cover copy, although honestly it's probably the 4th or 24th iteration. Cleveland lawyer Casey Court is desperate to get her practice off of life and support. When a federal judge seeks her out for her expertise in juvenile court, Casey thinks she's found a lifeline. Frustrated with Cuyahoga County's arbitrary handling of abuse and neglect cases, Casey's determined to keep the judge's daughter from the clutches of foster care, but she's unprepared for a system that snubs its nose at justice. While the client prone to self-sabotage, can Casey redeem herself by saving them both? Judged is the first book in the high-stakes Casey Court legal thriller series. If you like strong women, shocking political corruption, and gripping stories ripped from the headlines, you'll love Amy Austin's explosive novel. It is what it is. So, Judged. I started writing the book. It was the 90s, people, the 90s. So, like every author, you read enough books. So, if you watched or, listened to the podcast that I've had for the last 5 years called A Time to Thrill, the majority of people that I interview are indeed authors. And we talk a lot about what influenced us to write. And for a majority of us, I think the last people I interviewed were just only children. A lot of us were introverted children who apparently had way too much time on their hands. We were not out farming or doing any of those things that previous generations of children had done. So maybe you were one of the first or second generations in America to have a surplus of free time and great public libraries. And so many of us spent a lot of time reading. I know that I did. You know, I have a Goodreads list of all the books I've read for the last, I don't know how many years, and it's thousands. And that's when I started making notes, mainly because I kept rereading the same books or downloading or buying the same books. And so I have read lots and lots of books, the majority of them are probably romance. And I'd say 50%. The other 50% is probably between thriller, mystery, anything and everything, and a lot of nonfiction about whatever topic interested me at the moment, good or bad. But I got to the point where I'm sure a lot of people do, where I thought, not only do I want to be a writer, I do not want to be a newspaper writer. I can't even find my clips file. I don't know what happened to it. It's driving me crazy right now. But I didn't want to be a newspaper writer. I thought about writing magazine features, but I never got on that bandwagon, which I guess is good because we hardly ever print magazines anymore and we don't really have a lot of print newspapers, ironically. So I didn't do those, but I thought to myself, the one thing maybe I can do is write a book. It is such, I can't think of the right word right now. It's actually eluding me, but just the gall to think, I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a book. It is so much harder than it appears to be. So the first book I wrote, it was after law school, 98, 99. I had bought a new house, so 99 maybe. And I thought to myself, okay, I'll write a book. And I've had these experiences, and so I'll combine my experience as an attorney working in a system with, I don't know, my desire to write a book. To say that it was horrible, the first couple of drafts, is an understatement. Like, it's so weird to have read so many books and then think I can do it, and then it be so hard. It was so hard. So hard. Okay. If you have ever, I don't know, I don't even know where I saw this, read The Great Santini or have read an interview with Pat Conroy, he talks about the fact that many people's first book is autobiographical and that I believe his family wasn't speaking to him after he wrote it. The only thing I remember is, hey, sports fans, and I'll leave it there. But I highly recommend Pat Conroy. All that said, the first book I wrote is indeed partially autobiographical. It combined sort of what I imagined my childhood would have been like had I, what is that? What is the word I want to say? Had I sounded the alarm about what was going on in my home, and if I guess I had been my savior on the other end as an attorney. It's kind of interesting to think about that now. That's what therapy's for, right? So Judged is the first book, the first Casey Court. At the time I wrote it, I planned to try to write a single book. I had no plans for a series. I had no plans to maybe transition romance. I had no plans to write like 30 books, like none of that. I was like, if I could write a book, wouldn't that be amazing? My late 20s self. I was influenced a lot by Philip Margolin at the time. So Philip Margolin is a, well, he's an attorney from, I don't, Multnomah County. Where is that? Seattle? Portland. One of the two. And he, what I really liked about his books was that he wrote multiple points of view. But more than two, like romance had, the thing I had read had moved from like maybe one to two. He wrote multiple points of view, and he also wove a story in a certain way that I really loved. He would just tell you these things, like, I'm going to tell you about Joe, and I'm going to tell you about Jane, and I'm going to tell you about Jill, I'm going to tell you about Jeremy. And when you get to chapter 15, 30, whatever, you will now know why you need to all know all of these facts. How they weave into this brilliant story, and look at what I've done. And I admire that storytelling so much. I probably still do. I just don't read Philip Marlin anymore. But I admire that kind of storytelling. I was like, oh, if I could just tell you like different people's stories and weave them in, and then you get this tale, wouldn't that be amazing? Yeah, that's a lot of talent I didn't have. So to be frank. So that's where I was going when I sat down to write the book. So in this book, there are three characters. The first is Olivia Grant. Actually, I'll never forget the characters' names, who at the time is 12 or 13. She's in 7th grade in Shaker Heights. She is a child, and I sort of wanted to give the perspective of what it would be like to be a child in a dysfunctional household. The second character is Sheila Harrison Grant. She's an attorney who becomes a judge, therefore has some stakes around that, and is an alcoholic. And then there's Casey Court, who is this, it's a David and Goliath sort of tale. She's clearly David, where she is an underdog, a single person trying to like buck a huge system. It's not so much against her. I think it's just like my belief of the justice system. It's just a grinding. Like it's like a meat grinder, and you're in it, and you hope for the best that comes out. Maybe you get sausage, maybe you get like who knows what. So that's like
That's what my intention was. But I will say this, and I don't ever really talk about this, but it's time. So I grew up with an alcoholic mother. I was as a single parent who was highly functioning in that she was able to maintain a job and I had a roof over our heads and all of that. But it was a slog. It was a slog. It was awful. And what I realized relatively early is that there weren't a lot of alternatives. So, like, if I had, okay, I grew up in the era of the after school special. So it was like, if you're experiencing whatever in your home, you should talk to your clergy, okay, atheist family, a counselor, a school counselor, or whatever, like, probably mandated reporter type people. And somehow, like, magical, mystical help will come down and rain on you. But I knew that it probably wasn't true because when I was little, my mother was a social worker, like a caseworker, and they go out and see clients. And she used to take me with her from time to time in New York City in public housing. This is not, let me tell you, this is. It is what you would think it is. So in like the 70s, public housing in New York City was, I don't know what it was. There were all these, so I lived in a house in Brooklyn, so I did not have this experience. I always wanted to live in a tall apartment. Still hasn't come to fruition, but one day. So we would go to these, like, there's these like tall brick buildings in like Brooklyn, or I think actually mostly Manhattan. And you go, and the elevator wasn't always working. You'd have to go up the stairs. They always smelled like somebody had urinated. There was sometimes graffiti. The walls, I think, were like cinder block. It did not scream inviting home. And you'd go and visit these people. And this is like, I don't know, I was young and it's probably blocked out for a reason. Nothing about it, like, you would visit these families, and like, I guess they were probably foster families. Like, this is hard because I was little. Nothing about it said to me, oh, you should talk to somebody about what's going on in your home because there's an upgrade waiting for you. Like, I could see that there wasn't. So I did the best I could in the circumstances I was in, and here I am. All that said, I No, like, so when, this is, I gotta think about this because now that I say all this out loud, this probably is related, but at the time it felt like autonomous choices. So when I graduated from law school, I thought to myself, what can I don't know what I thought. I don't know what I thought, but what I ended up doing was divorce, which is fine. It's, well, it's not fine, but it's fine. But I also ended up working in juvenile court. So for $250 a case, I don't even know what you could buy with $250. The county paid, they didn't always pay on time. And for $250 a case, they would assign me as a guardian ad litem, me with, I don't know, 8 hours training, 16 hours training, 40 hours training, whatever the training was, to meet children who were in foster care or sometimes in their own homes, but the parents had been. Somebody had filed a case against them alleging abuse or neglect, usually, or dependency. And I was assigned to go in, interview whomever, I don't know, parents, teachers, whatever, give me the power and I will call anybody and talk to anybody about anything. And then make a written report about what would be in the best interest of these children. That's the system I walked into. And what I observed as a 20-something-year-old was no different than what I observed as a 5, 6, 7-year-old, which was that for all that was wrong with their families, I'm not sure that foster care was better. I mean, it was what it was. I mean, it was the parents were usually poor, often black, mostly. This is in Cuyahoga County, Ohio. The foster parents were also mostly poor, just less poor and black, but they were supplemented by payments. from the county that they would not necessarily pay the parents, where a lot of problems could be solved that way. It was wild to watch parents, like, they would lose their children. This is dependency. They would lose their children because, like, say, for instance, they couldn't pay for heat, and so they didn't have heating, or they didn't have adequate food. So then they would pay, I don't know, I think it was $600. I could be wrong, don't ask me. A month to a foster family who would then be able to provide heat and food. So I'm a fan of the minimal payment or minimal income or whatever it's called, because if those parents could have had that money, they probably could have provided for the children. Then there were, like, abuse, and that's awful. Like, did I hit my kids? Did I burn my kids? Oh my God, did I put my kids in the oven? Don't ask. Yeah, don't ask. I may not recover from that day in court. Wasn't even my case. I was just sitting there. Anyway, don't put your children in an oven. So, and or the parents were often, so there's abuse, and then the parents were often drug dependent, and so therefore could not provide care. So I walked into that system, and there were no good answers. I, as a guardian ad litem, was not providing, like, the magic answer to what was best for the children. And that became abundantly clear quite quickly. Caseworkers, social workers were overloaded. They were not paid well. It was just a system. The judges I did not feel were very caring. And look, I'm not a judge. I'm not a judicial officer. I have not had, like, some severe, like, case overload where, like, I mean, I think it would grind anybody down. Like, by day 40 or year six, you're just like, here we go, more kids in the system. Like, what can I do to just, like, get through the day and go home to my own family? All that said, so that's, like, the backdrop for this. So these are the three characters I developed for this book. And it was a slog to write it. So the book itself, I'm sorry, I'm looking over here at Kindle Notes. The book itself is 40, 41 chapters, maybe 80, 90,000 words. I'd have to actually look at that. And the iPad's slow, imagine that. Dear iPad, why are you taking me there? So all that said, and this is the book. So the format stayed the same across the series, like the 15 books or whatever it is. Everything was a date. I don't know why that seemed important to me, but that could anchor it in time and with the character. So every chapter of every book is a character name and date. The first book, I had thematic chapter names. That was a lot of work. Never did it again. Never did it again. I couldn't imagine having to come up with, like, a thematic name for every chapter of every book I ever wrote. Nope. Zero. Not gonna happen. But I do love a date. Love a date. Love a date. Love a date and a character name. Actually, in romance, I think there's character names, but no dates. Okay, so here we go. It is the first chapter of the book is Party Night. And in the chapter, Olivia Grant is, okay, so let me set the scene, I guess. Sorry, there's a lot of stuff in the book in the beginning. Sorry, the front matter. Let me set the scene. So Olivia, she and her mom, and at some point her dad, lived in Cleveland, Ohio, in, I think, a black neighborhood, East Side neighborhood. I'd have to look it up. Don't ask. And her mom decides that moving to a suburb would be better for the kid. They move from Cleveland to Shaker Heights, which at the time, and maybe to this day, has a well-regarded public school. It's a suburb. I lived there and I paid the taxes. Taxes are higher than here in LA, where everything is really expensive. The taxes were higher than here. I'd have to buy, well, whatever. High taxes when I moved here and people were complaining. I was like, this is a tax break, people. Don't you worry. So super high taxes. And they mainly go to support the school district, and they had a lot of programs and a lot of things that people who lived there enjoyed. The Shaker High School District encompassed the city and a little ring of part of Cleveland, where I had actually also lived. I lived in two places in Ohio for the 5 years I was there. There's a reason why Encompass is part of Cleveland. I don't remember it. Skip it. Not important. So Olivia's mom, Sheila, moves them to Shaker Heights. She lives in a two-family house. There were two family houses on the south side of Shaker Heights that were actually disguised as single-family homes. I actually lived in one. It was the first house I bought. It was cute the way they just it was me it like it was really good architecture. It actually it's laid out a little bit like Beverly Hills in that same like way, but like interesting architecture, interesting layout. I know a lot about it. We're not going to go down that road. So she moves her there. I had a similar thing that happened to me. I left Brooklyn and moved to an all-white suburb in Connecticut. So to Olivia's credit, not as white of a suburb Shaker was at the time or is as the suburb I moved to in Connecticut. Oh, so white. Probably still is. I'd have to actually Google the demographics. And that feeling of being not only a new kid, but in middle school, and then also feeling like the only Black kid, that is something I experienced and I could certainly write about. As people say now, my lived experience or whatever. I could certainly write about that sort of sense of loneliness, isolation, wanting to fit in, but not being able to. So Olivia on this night is like finally invited out to a party. She's like super excited. The mom drives them all in some big SUV to, I can't remember the restaurant. Maybe it was Benihana. Benihana was popular then at the time. I think they're all gone. And farther east in Shaker or Beachwood or whatever. And so she goes, and while she's there and like invited, she doesn't really fit in. And I certainly experienced this. I know this. All that said, so that's like where we're starting. People sort of making fun of her. They make this joke, which actually did happen to me. I remember who said it. It's actually somebody I follow on social media, so I probably shouldn't. I'm not getting into that. At the time, I had a crush when I was in 7th, 8th grade. It was middle school. I don't remember which grade. Some white kid, boy, who didn't like me back. Surprise. And Black girls weren't cool yet. The Black girl magic thing had not happened. And so, no. And I remember telling somebody that I had a crush on him. And they said, oh, your kid's going to be zebras because they're going to be Black and white striped. It is what it is. And so I incorporated that little story into the first chapter. So, you know, Olivia's in this car and she's like riding along. And so he makes that joke. And it's just like, she's like, I thought I was fitting in this group, but really look how isolated I am. And then the mom who's driving the 4 or 6 kids, whatever, girls in the SUV, like pulls up to her house and like drops her off. And my perception is, and I don't know, maybe this is true. I'd actually have to think like way too far back into the past. Is that like other people dropped off and their moms like were at the door and like greeted them. I did not have such an experience. I had a key and I had to get in the house. Actually, this doesn't happen anymore, but there's a hook in my purse for the key. So, and also my doors have like those like combo locks. So I don't need keys all the time. But I will say this, when I was a kid, I, for the life of me, could not remember my keys. Oh my God. When I was little, like in New York City, I think I wore them on a chain around my neck. But when I moved to the suburb of Connecticut, I guess I didn't. I don't know. I don't know why I lost my keys. I don't know. I don't know. I don't lose my keys anymore, so I don't have to worry about it. But I couldn't always remember my keys. So in my personal experience, I actually don't remember where I was, but I remember I'd gone out and I went home, and this is before cell phones, and I like rang the doorbell and my mother didn't wake up. I think she was passed out, inebriated as it were. She didn't wake up. So then I think I went down to payphone with my dime or quarter or whatever, probably dime, and tried to call. And phones then, like landlines, were really loud. And she didn't answer. And then I was like, well, it's nighttime and it's cold, and what am I gonna do? So I did do this. I did break into my own house. So, like, back in the day, actually, I have a solid door now, so I should be grateful. There were these doors, like, all over the East Coast that had, like, either 8 panes or 12 panes in them. And it was the front door. I don't even know, like, the outside door before the vestibule. And I broke a pane and twisted the lock and then let myself in. Not great. Who knows what happened afterwards? Like, I don't know. Well, I like to say I remember everything, but clearly I don't remember everything. But this is the catalyst that starts the book. And I will say that I think, now that I think about it, a lot of my books start with something that happens. I once wrote a book where, like, a dog was on the freeway. And indeed, I actually did see a dog on the freeway once, and everybody get out to try to help the dog. And it started a book. And actually, I'm about to write a book now with something that actually happened. I saw it on the street. So, that's often a catalyst. But the reason this happened is because Sheila Harrison Grant, Olivia Grant's mom, was passed out. And you're just like, oh, this girl doesn't have friends, doesn't seem to have a lot of family around, is fairly isolated, and she can't even get into her own house. And that's it. That is actually chapter one. So the note, the first line of the first book I ever wrote was, I never knew what I was going to encounter when I went home. It was always best if I tackled it alone. And actually, I felt that. So the note is actually, the note says, this Casey Court book is the most autobiographical of any of the books I've written. I grew up with a mother who, from age 10, started the slow slide into alcoholism. I was what was then referred to as a latchkey kid. Oh my God, I'm dating myself. So coming home in the afternoon to an empty house was a pleasure. Going out at night, though, was more complicated. Uncertainty is hard for preteens. Oh, that's true. That's true. So the book goes on. That's like the main note from that chapter. Long chapter. I'm better now. Oh, chapter two is Sheila Harrison Grant. And I think there's actually no notes, but basically, there will be spoilers. So basically, Sheila presides over a case where, like, a child who was injured, who had bad things happen to them, and foster care is suing. And I'm sure I wrote it, like, it's like I'm pretty much as, like, transparent as plastic wrap. I'm pretty sure I wrote it to sort of illustrate, to mirror or presage what was going to happen, that children in foster care, a lot of bad things happen to them. Moving on. The next chapter, is chapter three, where I have a note, and that's the first Casey Court chapter. I'd actually have to look to see how old she is in this book. I actually don't know. Oh, I love this. So Casey Court, it's October 9, 2001. She says, my hand-me-down Honda Accord sputtered along Superior Avenue. I tried not to let the red needle hovering around the E on the gas gauge freak me out. So I want you to know that she has no money. So even though she's an attorney, and I'm not sure if you know that yet, she has no money. And in this chapter, she's going to visit a child who is in foster care. I'm pretty sure probably in a foreign, in a, I can say this, poor neighborhood. So she says, like, she goes to see this kid, yada yada. Then in this paragraph, she says, my rent was due in a few days. My bank account was looking nearly as grim as my wallet. As I punched in the toll-free number for the motor club, I think her car must break down. Oh, she ran out of gas. I thought, not for the first time, I had to give up these time-sucking, money-losing cases. Doing the right thing was what had landed me in this predicament in the first damn place. I was tired of being right. I'd rather be rich. That's many books before she actually gets out of debt, I don't think. And so the post-it note says, there's so much to talk about pro bono and legal aid work. I had a friend who was mortified to learn, oh, this happened, I forgot about this, was mortified to learn that while helping a new legal aid client complete income qualification forms, that the client earned more than she did and had less debt. I know there's a perception, maybe, I actually don't know anymore. When I graduated from law school, there was a perception that lawyers were rich. I remember applying for a loan, the mortgage, for the first house and talking to the mortgage officer. And he was like, what do you and my husband, now ex at the time, do? And I was like, oh, we're both attorneys. And he was like, oh, so you have a lot of money. And then I turned over the income statements and he was like, what? And I was like, do we qualify? And he was like, well, actually, I'm not going to get into it. There was a lot of me applying for like grants and stuff to actually qualify for that first mortgage. Because if there's nothing I can do better, it's fill out a form and figure out stuff. And so based on the income alone, probably not so much. But that said, there was this perception that lawyers are rich, and probably still that. And the number of lawyers I know who are barely scraping by or new at the time is really, really high. And even now when I look at ads for like entry-level attorney positions, they are paying in actual real dollars less than they paid 25, 30 years ago, which means in inflationary dollars, paying nothing. And the cost of law school has ballooned and the loans have ballooned. And what you should know about Casey Cord is that she is first generation American. Her parents are Polish and German, more or less. There's a whole story about that later in a different book. And while they sent her to a Catholic school and did their best to support her in college, she was pretty much on her own in graduate school and is the first person in her family to graduate from college and graduate school. But to do it, she had to do it with loans. And so, as everyone knows, the loans in America are a huge burden. They're not dischargeable in bankruptcy court, and you're stuck with them. Those payments come like 6 months after graduation, and they come, and they come, and they come, and they're a lot. And she has to navigate that, loans, you know, rent, not a car payment because she has a paid for car that, you know, does what it does. But navigating all of that while working cases that don't pay a lot. So I realize I'm 30 minutes in. I think I'll stop that here. But that's like the basis of the first three chapters of Judged. This is Amy Austin. I want you to like, subscribe, share, and you can follow me everywhere, YouTube, Instagram. That's where I am. Other places I try, but you know, I'm a legal thriller author everywhere. And thank you for joining me for this first part of the breakdown of Judged. I'll be back. I got a million books. I got a million chapters. See you soon. If you're curious while I'm talking about the story behind the story, my book Judged is actually free everywhere right now. Apple, Kobo, Nook, Google Play, Amazon, all of them.